and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Improving access to mental health services on the city's south side. Learning the hidden history of Black civil rights with the author of the book, Before the Movement.
We actually have a retail store that we put in there to answer the demand for fresh fruit and vegetables.
And Austin residents get a lesson in urban farming. Now to some of today's top stories. The federal judge overseeing Michael Madigan's racketeering case refuses to toss out several charges just days before the trial is set to begin. District Judge John Blakey denied defense attorney's motion to toss out a handful of charges, including bribery counts, after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling narrowed the federal bribery statute earlier this year. The former Illinois House Speaker is facing charges related to racketeering, bribery, wire fraud, and attempted extortion. His trial is set to begin next week. The man charged in the Highland Park July 4th parade shooting is told his upcoming murder trial will proceed whether he chooses to be present or not. Robert Cremo III, who remains in custody at the Lake County Jail, once again refused to attend a status hearing for his case today. Cremo is set to stand trial in February on 7 counts of first-degree murder and dozens of other charges. He was indicted just days after the 2022 mass shooting that killed 7 people and injured 50 others. Mayor Brandon Johnson refuses to rule out a property tax increase as the city scrambles to plug a ballooning budget deficit while expanding services.
Everything is on the table, right? I have to deal with this deficit while also investing in people. And investments are up. $1.25 billion investment for economic development and housing. We're building affordable homes. We're still doing that. So we're going to do everything in our power to, of course, to fix this challenge. But we also have to be very clear that the way to transform this city, this state, this country, the rich and the ultra wealthy have to pay their fair share in taxes.
Johnson campaigned on a promise not to raise property taxes, but the city is facing a $223 million deficit this year and a nearly $1 billion deficit for 2025. For more on the city's budget woes, please check out our website. Chicago area doctors who spent 3 weeks working at a Gaza hospital earlier this year are calling for a ceasefire. Emergency medicine doctor Thayer Ahmad spoke at a news conference today and said what he saw in Gaza was unlike anything he had seen before.
What we have seen over the last year has been a total 360-degree assault on life in Gaza. People are not able to earn a living. Children are not able to go to school. People are not able to move from area to area unless they're running away from bombs. They're living in makeshift tents. And so I hope that there is the political will that is necessary to establish a ceasefire.
The ceasefire call comes just one day after Iran launched a barrage of roughly 200 missiles at Israel in response to the assassination of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. Israel has vowed to respond to the missile attack. Up next, changing the makeup of mental health crisis teams, right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Chicago will no longer have members of the police and fire departments on its mental health emergency response teams. The Crisis Assistance Response and Engagement Program, also known as CARE, is moving to a new staffing model with all public health workers. It's part of Mayor Brandon Johnson's plan to end criminalization of mental health issues and help people get the care they need. But advocates say there is still much more work to be done to improve access. Joining us via Zoom are Cheryl Miller, public health organizer for Southside Together Organizing Power, also known as Stop Chicago, and Ani Humani, a treatment not trauma organizer with the Brighton Park Neighborhood Council. They're both members of the Collaborative for Community Wellness Coalition. And we also invited the Chicago Department of Public Health this evening, but they declined our request. We thank Cheryl and Ani for joining us. Cheryl Miller, let's start with you. Please describe the state of mental health supports and services in the communities that you work with on the South Side.
There is a dire need for mental health care on the South Side and on the West Side. We have the Collaborative for Community Wellness, CCW, did a study, a provider survey that showed that 3/4 of the city had less than 2/10 of one therapist per 1,000 people, whereas downtown and near north had 4.3 providers per 1,000 persons. So the need is dire, and we absolutely need the public mental health centers. They are barrier free in terms of cost, in terms of insurance, in terms of immigration status. So that is why we have been fighting so hard to not just reopen the centers that were closed, all of the centers that were closed, and also to expand.
It sounds like you're saying there's basically sort of a desert there of access to services. Ani Humani, the city recently announced its crisis assistance response and engagement program would move forward with all public health staff. First, tell us what this program is and how it works.
Yeah, thank you. So basically, this crisis program is supposed to reach someone that's in crisis, but in particular, a mental health crisis. Currently, it's only working in certain parts of the city. It's still not citywide. However, these teams are made up of mental health professionals. No longer are there any cops in these teams, but there should be. Something that we're also advocating for is the community care corps, which is the peer support workers, to help prevent with people going into crisis. Essentially, these teams provide support and de-escalate any situation or try to de-escalate as much as possible so people in crisis aren't criminalized.
So basically, if a call should come in to Chicago's dispatch, rather than a Chicago police officer being sent, if it is deemed that there's a mental health crisis happening, a cop is not sent, a mental health professional is sent instead.
Yes, that should be happening.
Cheryl, as you mentioned, the Collaborative for Community Wellness Coalition, you all analyzed 911 behavioral calls from January 2019 to February 2022. What did that analysis show?
We looked at, I'm sorry, there's several different studies, so that particular study I wasn't a part of, but over the different time periods that I have looked at, analyze call patterns. One of the things that we were able to see is that there were increased number of calls, mental health and behavioral health calls in communities that had formerly had a public mental health center. So we can really see that these centers are vital for people's lives and health.
What else do we know about those communities that have the increased amount of calls?
Well, we know they don't have, that they do not have providers in them, and they're not clinicians. They don't have services. They often are communities that have been divested from other types of needs. So these are communities that have a high need and high stress. So these are very, you know, very important to be able to start bringing in public mental health care services, because that will serve the community, and it will be, they will be a hub, you know, use this to be a hub for community wellness.
The city recently reported that the care team dispatches have resulted in zero arrests and use of force was used or applied in less than 0.1%, so 0.1% of incidents. Ani, now that, you know, this transition has happened, what else needs to happen in order to improve the way the city handles and responds to mental health challenges?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing now is building that bridge. We got the first step to moving care into CDPH. Now we need to build that bridge between the care teams, but also the public mental health centers to provide long-term care and hopefully start preventing more mental health crises along the way. This is something that we've like continuously advocated for, but also the community care corps that we actually wrote about in our white paper, which are peer support workers, community members being employed by the city to support their own community members who are going through a mental health crisis. So I think the next step would definitely be that bridge between crisis response and mental health centers to ensure that people are getting the proper care post-crisis, but also hopefully long-term care to help them prevent any future crisis.
Cheryl, as Ani said, right now the care team is only operational in certain parts of the city. What's the likelihood that it expands to other communities that also need it?
I think it will be highly likely. This mayor, unlike previous mayors, has made this issue a priority issue, and also does understand why we need to have a crisis response that doesn't result in further criminalization and further trauma of people who, you know, like we, even if no charges ended up being pressed against someone, you know, we have case of someone
that interaction
herself.
With the police. Oh, geez. Yes. Yeah. That right. Interaction with the police itself can be traumatic.
It's correct.
For many people.
And so, and like what you showed is that, and what we've known and been saying all along, 95% of mental health crisis calls are nonviolent. They do not involve a crime. It would be like, you would send somebody was having an asthma attack and couldn't get their breathing under control, and then you sent a police car. Nothing about that is going to help that person.
Right. And we also know, of course, American Rescue Plan Act or ARPA provided funding for nonprofits to provide mental health services. But we also know that funding is drying up. So it's a conversation that we'll have to continue having with you all about how this problem is being addressed. But we're out of time for now. My apologies, Cheryl Miller and Ani Humani. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, a look at Black Americans and the law. Stay with us. African Americans were fighting for their rights through common law long before what we think of as the civil rights movement. That's the conclusion author Dylan Penningroth came to after rummaging through county courthouses and interviewing plenty of Black Americans to explore a civil rights story dating back to the 1830s. His book is called Before the Movement, The Hidden History of Black Civil Rights. And author Dylan Penningroth joins us now. He is a professor of law and history at UC Berkeley And we'll be sharing this book with audiences at the Chicago Humanities Fest this week. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you opened this book with a family story that raises a question for you and led you to write this book. What was that story?
It's the story of my great-great-great uncle, Jackson Holcomb. He was an enslaved man in Southside, Virginia, which is a place that I visited often when I was a small child. There's a recording of my great-great-uncle, Thomas Holcomb, talking about Jackson Holcomb. And on the tape, he says that Jackson Holcomb, while he was a slave, had a boat. And in that boat, during the closing days of the Civil War, when Confederate soldiers are running all through the woods, desperate for a ride across the Appomattox River, he gave them a ride. And when they got to the other side, they paid him. And I thought
money.
To myself, they paid him real money. And I thought to myself, why? Why would a bunch of heavily armed white men who are fighting to preserve slavery pay a black man money who was in slavery without so much as a second thought? And that's the question that began me on this journey toward the book.
I have so many questions about that story alone that I know, we talk about in the book, because not only, why were those Confederate soldiers willing to pay a man who was a slave, but also the man who was a slave owned the boat and was in a position to receive money from Confederate soldiers, from men who wanted to maintain his enslavement.
Yes, absolutely. And that, I think that the important thing to recognize here, the important thing to notice is that they didn't think about it. It was so casual, so taken for granted. I think that's a clue. The clue is that white people in the South in 1865, they were used to making deals with black people who were in slavery. They were used to seeing black people own boats, cows, horses, chickens, things like that. Black people like my great-great-uncle Jackson Holcomb didn't have rights to those boats. They didn't have civil rights. But they had privileges that were so widely understood by white Southerners, and they were part of the same legal system, the same system of understandings, that white Southerners generally respected them unless there was something untoward happening. So it's the routineness of that interaction that I think is most interesting to me. That means that when civil rights come, that transition is a turning point in some ways, but in other ways, it's not so much of a turning point at all.
The premise of this book, it seems to be, sort of about the history that may have been forgotten about how blacks engaged with the law well before the civil rights movement that we know of, over the course of the 400 years that we've been a part of this country. What is that history that's been forgotten?
So I think typically when we think of civil rights, or at least when I think of civil rights, I think of Martin Luther King, the March on Washington. I think of Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. It turns out that Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, they are the heirs to a 150-year-long tradition of black people using, thinking about, and talking about civil rights. But they're not the civil rights that you see in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. They're not about discrimination on the basis of race, sex, or other categories. They're about the right to own property, the right to make contracts, the right to go to court. Those are actually the original civil rights that are written into America's first national civil rights law, the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And so it's that tradition of black people using those civil rights that actually forms the foundation for the civil rights movement that we know so well.
You mentioned, that it was just sort of not necessarily taken for granted, but like whites were used to regularly engaging and sort of making these contracts and deals with blacks, be they enslaved or freed at the time. What was sort of their engagement or response or reaction to making these sort of contracts and blacks, going about their everyday lives, really?
Yeah. It's a really interesting question. Why would white people, why would white Southerners in places like Mississippi or Southside Virginia, why would they allow or countenance black people having civil rights? And the answer is that it was in their interest. And this actually is something that I'm borrowing from the great critical race theorist, Derrick Bell. He had this theory of interest convergence, that is to say, that black people's rights will be advanced if and only if it also is in the interests of white people. And you see this over and over again in my records. If you think about what is a sharecropping contract, it's a way of exploiting black people, not in spite of law, but through law. They needed black people to have civil rights.
to do all of this and all of this research, because we're going back several hundred years here. You had to get off the beaten path, as we said. You had to dig through some courthouses and some basements of some black people who let you dig around in their basements. What did you find in all of this? Because the thing I'm also fascinated by is that these records still exist.
Well, it is kind of amazing that they still exist. Part of the reason is that they're considered by law to be permanent records. And so in the states, in the county courthouses, what I did is I would drive around, I'd get in a rental car, and I'd go to the courthouse, and I'd ask the clerk or the deputy clerk for permission to go in the back. And as often as not, they said, fine, no problem.
Also, what do you want back there?
What do you want back there? Exactly, because, you know, they're writing traffic tickets.
They don't think there's anything there, yes.
Exactly. Sometimes I got to talking with them, and they're really interesting to talk with. But what you find in the back there is, number one, how often black people were actually in these courthouses. So it's often sort of an impression that we get that black people came to court or came into their rights for the very first time in the 1950s. But in fact, they were there all along. They just weren't arguing against discrimination. And then the second thing that you find in there is stories. These stories are stories that you can almost not get from any other source. They're stories about black people's interior lives, their loves, their annoyances, their pettiness sometimes. And these are really rich and deeply human stories. That's the kind of thing that I was interested in finding in the courthouses. And they are such precious documents of our nation's history.
Part four of your book is dedicated to the movement era, and in chapter 11, you detail the importance, of course, of the Brown versus Board of Education ruling. What did your research reveal about Thurgood Marshall's strategy in that case?
So Thurgood Marshall, it's really interesting. Thurgood Marshall is considered today a civil rights lawyer, right? But most of the time, what lawyers like him tended to do was they took property cases, they took contract cases, they represented churches. That's the way that they had to pay the bills. Brown versus Board of Education, the remedy that they were seeking was an injunction ordering the Topeka School Board to admit Linda Brown. There was no money in it for him. And to this day, civil rights lawyers have to face this dilemma. They are engaged in an enterprise that doesn't really pay. And so often to keep the lights on, they have to handle also the other kinds of things, which actually turn out to be the kinds of things that black people in 1900 and 1950 cared about very deeply. That is, these everyday civil rights.
Like their access to property, to their home ownership, their marriage contract.
Exactly. So if you think about the church that Martin Luther King led, Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, it's a corporation. The Montgomery bus boycott, 1956, they form a corporation. Martin Luther King is the president. That allows them to bring in money, pay out the people who are driving the carpools.
Well, and Dylan, we don't want to give everybody, they got to read the book. You don't want to give it all away because we're actually out of time. Dylan Penningroth, thank you again for joining us. We appreciate it. Again, the book is called Before the Movement, The Hidden History of Black Civil Rights. And you can catch Dylan Penningroth at UIC on Saturday for an event with the Chicago Humanities Festival. Up next, exploring healthy eating in the Austin community. A nonprofit group in the city's Austin neighborhood is showing off the area's green spaces one trolley stop at a time. Chicago Austin Youth Travel Adventures is hosting farm-to-table trolley tours where residents visit community farms and learn about healthy eating. The area is still considered a food desert, so increasing access to fresh foods is something organizers hope their neighbors can get on board with.
The people in Austin need the access to, number one, improve their health. I know so many people personally with different types of disorders that, you know, from eating high-fat foods. And so to give people the opportunity to learn, guess what? We have gardens here.
Crystal Dyer is the founder of Chicago Austin Youth Travel Adventures, which oversees the trolley tours that visit community farms.
One thing about African Americans and myself, living my own life, is when people refer me to something, I'm more likely to go.
PCC Austin Farm is one of the stops on the tour.
We actually have a retail store that we put in there to answer the demand for fresh fruit and vegetables. We sell everything at an accessible price so that the community can come in there and they don't have to like get on a bus or get on a train. I mean, I have two kids and I couldn't imagine having to bring groceries home on a train.
Dominique Stevens is the senior manager for health and wellness at Windy City Harvest, the Chicago Botanic Gardens urban agriculture program. She says healthy eating can be achieved by everyone.
I think using a lot of fresh produce is a really good way to sort of keep your culture alive. So we sell a lot of like greens. So people come to our farm stand and they'll be like, I need collards, I need mustards. And they're telling us about the recipes that they're making with them. It is possible to keep your culture intact and it doesn't have to necessarily be, you know, super fried.
My favorite is cabbage with okra. You know, I can eat that all day long. I don't need anything else because just the flavor and the texture, you know, with a little spice.
A cooking demonstration is also included in the tour.
I like to ask everyone who buys something that I'm not familiar with cooking, I say, how do you prepare that? And then I see if I can prepare it in the same way. And that just helps me feed my kids healthier, feed myself healthier, but still be eating some of that culturally specific food.
And the trolley tours are running through the end of the month. And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Early voting is kicking off in Chicago this week. A rundown of what you need to know. And we explore the retro, weird, and cool junk at an antique shop in Pilsen. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its 20 attorneys recognized in the 2025 edition of the Best Lawyers in America.